Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the Lantern Rouge Cycling Podcast for our weekly show, Sunday evening recording, brought to you by Join Cycling. We're going to wrap up the recap very quickly, the Paris-Nice Stage 1. We're also going to preview that race, Paris-Nice, the whole race, as well as Tirreno-Adriatico. We're going to have Daly. Was he in the wrong or right when he was mad in Le Samin last week? As well as some other crazy news in cycling. People dressing up as riders to sign on and getting found out and suspended. We've got big extensions with Schelmers at Sheffield, a one cycling update, and a hookless rim special where we're bringing in Alex from Peak Talk as well to fill us in on why the UCI might be looking at banning or investigating hookless rims after some high profile punctures recently. But what have you been up to, Benji? You went to GP Montserrat today.
Yes, I did. I went to one of the ChatGPT generated races in Belgium, and I'll be honest, it was I kind of enjoyed it. I feel like I've grown fond of these smaller races because it's so accessible. When it comes to these bigger races, World Tour races like the Tour de France, for example, if you go to a race like that, it's harder to speak to the riders. Because like from a spectator point of view, and now I can just waltz into the bus zone area and start talking with everybody, which is quite fun. Can't complain. So that was fun. I didn't watch the entire race because it was way too rainy for me to walk onto a cobble section to spectate cycling. So I went to my couch instead.
Fair enough. And what sort of race is it? Like, how would you just say it's distinctive from the other Belgian races, Benji?
The real question is it distinctive? As in, I feel like it's fairly similar to yesterday's race, GP Crickleon, as in it's likely a reduced bench sprint because of the heavy parkour of like every now and then there's a cobble section, every now and then there's a bit of a hill, which in West Flanders...
That's every Flemish race.
But there's bad weather, which was also the case yesterday, so true, it's not very distinctive. But hey, it exists, so I'm happy.
Anyway, it was... No, I actually like Belgian races. Le Samin was really exciting last week. It was better than Strade on Saturday, that's for sure. But just a quick recap of Paris-Nice Stage 1 today. There's obviously the highlight video I just put out before this recording on Lantern Rouge YouTube channel. But we had a bonus second gate. ASO loves these. And you know what? I love them too, because it always induces the GC guys to kick off.
Yeah.
There's some bonus seconds at the top of a hill. They do it Tour de France Stage 1 every year now. And Paris-Nice Stage 1. And something very similar happened this year. Jorgensen was in good position, takes the bonies. Remco, terrible position, still takes the second position. Bernal there. Bernal looking very, very good. And then Remco wanted to continue with it. And like Vingegaard was the party pooper with Poggi last year, Jorgensen did the same thing this year.
Mate, the comparison to go with is for me Roglic in Basque Country against Remco. As
or
in
Catalonia.
Was it Catalonia or Basque? I don't know which one
last
it was.
Year.
That being said, he was staying on the wheel and so forth. So
yeah,
that vibe I was getting once again. And
Remco. That later.
But talk about Roglic. He wasn't there. He was out of position. And his positioning didn't look very safe today, I would say.
No, he couldn't keep it. Like Bora, I think whoever was... It wasn't Sobrero. There was someone in front of Sobrero. I don't know if it was Jungels or Haller or Van Poppel. But they
or
did
Dens?
Have guys ahead. Nah, he was looking shaky. He was looking real shaky. But he just couldn't hold their wheel, and like that's the biggest problem for Roglic in these. And these are like some of the most hectic stages. Northern France, near Paris, so much road furniture, hills, so they're coming off these hills in a big peloton, everyone's pretty fresh, 90 kilometers an hour, bang, into like a hairpin into a hill, and yeah, maintaining positions really hard, really dangerous. But then Roglic, it wasn't his legs, because then on the next hill, Bernal attacked off Quickstep's pacing. Remco's like, I'm going to go over the top of you. And then Roglic actually had to close the gap himself. He did that pretty quickly. And then on the plateau, no one worked with Remco and Van Wilder again. And so, it looked like it all came back. Trek kind of didn't have it under control for a moment because of those bonus seconds. Sprinters come back. We don't know who's in the group. We think Coy's there. Coquard's definitely there because Coffert is chase. And we get to the sprint. It's like an uphill drag, quite technical to run in. Visma have the most riders, but Sturven was the best last man. Really, really impressive work. But it was just, he did like a 600 meter pull on 6%. Really strong. No one came over the top of him, but it was just 300 meters for Pedersen with Coy in the wheel, and it leveled off. I think if it stayed uphill, Pedersen wins. But because it leveled off, that benefits Coy, and he wins by, I don't know, 10 centimeters, 15 centimeters, but enough to know he won over the line. So a really good opening stage, Benji.
Yep, I think so as well. And it's also like, it makes it more interesting that there's like an in-betweener between the hilly uphill sprint and the flat finish, like a combination of both, which meant I was unsure who of the two was actually going to take it in the end. Because, you know, when Pedersen starts its sprint at the front of the group, that he's good at keeping that position. But Coy is one of those sprinters that is now reaching to be one of the top sprinters in the future, as in he's second row, I would say, right now, between behind the Melier and Philipsons of the world. And he's still able to come past Pedersen, because on the flat, he's just superior towards Pedersen here. But anyway, I'm still curious what to see in the coming stage, because tomorrow's stage looks pretty good as well. But we'll go into that a bit later, or do we dive straight into the Paris-Nice preview from here?
No, we'll do Paris-Nice with Tirreno later. Okay. We also got Trofeo Laguelia, which was won by Lenny Martinez. He was the strongest probably rider overall, I would say.
Yeah.
And he was very, very aggressive on his own. He went clear on the last repetition of the climb after pacing the Colle Micheri, the second last one, attacking the guys about 3,000 times. And he soloed away, and he just on the Capo Mele, which I'm pretty sure is in Milan San Remo, he was able to hold off Jan Christen chasing him. UAE got into a bit of a pickle here where they put their second strongest rider ahead, maybe, Jan Christen. And Ayuso kind of messed it all up because he created a split third last climb, kept pushing, no teammates in the group, two Jaycos, two FDJs, got to the valley, stopped, and was like, oh no. And then they all attacked him. And then he waited, then Jan Christen went across, and then they kind of lived with it, but Christen wasn't as good as Martinez. So he wins ahead of Vendrame. Ayuso actually comes third in the end, coming way back. Scaroni was really good for Astana, but yeah, UA probably ruining that one, but they won on Saturday, I guess.
Yeah, certainly. And then when it comes to the other races, before we talk about our training for a bit, one more I'd say, which is about Le Samen. All these Belgian ChatGPT races all reduced sprints. Like, that's just the way it is. And Le Samen was also the case. Laurens Rix, Morgado, photo finish towards the end. Can we talk about late photo finishes for a second? Wow. Why did it take the organizers 2 hours to get the photo finish on Twitter?
They got to Photoshop the Belgian ahead.
I feel like there was like a flow chart of like, is there a Belgian in the picture? If yes, Photoshop.
Herben Thijssen against Ewan, Merlier against Ewan in UAE, now Rex against Morgado.
Pidcock Wout.
Wout against Pidcock. It's a conspiracy, Benji. But hey, I think Rex did win. I think he did win. But he celebrated too early and was like, oh, shit. And just like Coy, he got away with it. But Morgado, very, very impressive for someone who also said after the race, I don't even like these Belgian races.
Mate, he wasn't the only one, because there was an incident in the race with Arnaud Delis where, well, first of all, he had a mechanical issue. And as a follow-up of that mechanical issue, he was coming back towards the Peloton favorites group. He goes around the corner, but there's cars in the inside corner. And one of the cars slows down a little bit, the first one in the corner, and the second one reacts to that. And Delis seems to be taking the corner as if these cars aren't there, is the way I see it. Or he takes this inattentive of the fact that these cars could break at any point here. That's how I perceive it. But regardless of what, before we get to the car, go ahead.
Well, I think he thought they weren't going to brake.
Yeah.
And they were trying to give him the apex, but the black car, I think it was too late to give him the apex. Because normally if there's a rider coming back, the car brakes to let the rider come across. But it was too late for that. So it was like a miscommunication in what they each thought the other would do. But he also was taking a lot of risks. Like, he took the corner too fast as well. But yeah, then what happened after?
Well, I see it first of all as a combination. It's one, the car didn't react in the perfect way. And two, the Lee wasn't prepared for anything else than the perfect scenario. And as a consequence, he slides out. And he slides out, hurts himself a little bit to the point that he starts shouting at his own team car. He said the following words in not West Flemish, but in like Dutch. He said, "Wat doe ik hier in zo'n kutkoers?" And that basically means, what am I doing in this shit race? Which, this is part of the Lotto Cycling Cup, this race.
Yeah, Lotto. I saw Lotto sponsor every lap on the little hill. I mean, he's cut his teeth in these races. So, I mean, does that, to me, you don't have to say, but to me, that suggests that he wanted to do Koerner and they wanted him to do Le Sommet, would be, if I'm reading into that statement. Because they're like, what else could it be? But yeah, he crashes out. And then I think that even might have affected him in Paris-Nice today. Got dropped surprisingly early. So I think he might still be banged up from that crash.
When it comes to this specific situation, I'm like, you can have this tantrum in the race. I can forgive that with riders, especially when they're still young and so forth and not towards the end of their career. But then to come after the race and like keep hitting about the fact that he's super frustrated, and he was not only him but also his team was like saying this is the organizer's fault, stuff like that, where I feel like it's not 100% super obvious that it's one person's fault in this situation. So I feel like a more, this despite liking the immature reaction for the entertainment level, I feel like I expected a more mature response after the race.
Yeah, I mean, in the race after you crash, you can say what you like. I'm not going to criticize you for it because, like, you just crash and your adrenaline's peaked and your heart rate's at max. But yeah, after the race, there wasn't much accountability, and same with Omloop. So yeah, Lee done a little bit of yapping the last couple of weeks. I don't mind it because Remco's become very, like, inoffensive, I would say, the last year or two. So if we have we need a firebrand. saying whatever. So I say go for gold with Delee. But speaking of going for gold, we have our own Flandrian challenge, Benji. Not a ChatGPT challenge either. We're doing all the cobble sectors in the Tour of Flanders historically in, I think, 12 days, less than 10 days. And I've been using Join Cycling to get ready. I had a massive week on the trainer this week. It's literally, you can't see on the camera, but massive snow dump here last night. Impossible to train outside. And I had 2.5 hours today using the Join Workout Player, doing threshold efforts with sprints at the start so I can attack Benji in 10 days. I even think our producer Luke was looking for a training plan on Join, but because he's not been training. But I'm not sure there's one that can get him ready in 10 days. He's been skiing too much. Maybe there is. But yeah, I was just looking through my program now, Benji. I got rest day tomorrow. Tuesday, I got 2 hours sort of zone two, pretty chill. Then another zone two, 2 hours, pretty chill on Wednesday. And then Thursday, the same. So I think I got a taper week booked in here. And that's what I like. I don't have to think or use my brain. I just do the program. I do the plan. It's the classics plan set for the race. Or not. It's not a race. Not a race we're doing.
You keep saying race and I'm terrified.
Well, it's designed, the plan you put in, it's for a classics race. So then on the next Saturday I got taper efforts, I got a VO2 max intervals. So I'm sorry, but I'm not going to second guess the Join plan. I'm really, really happy with how it's going. So I'd encourage you all, if you want to check it out, whether you're in the southern or northern hemisphere, whether you want to get ready for summer or whether you want to stay in shape for winter in the southern hemisphere, there's a plan for you on the Join Cycling app, and you can get 30 days free trial, no credit card required, as well as a discount of 6 month subscription after that. So thanks to Join Cycling for supporting our weekly shows.
Question: have you ever ridden on a cobblestone?
Yeah. in La Seu all the time. In Spain has cobblestones, mate. Catalonia has cobblestones.
Which kind of cobblestones?
They're fucking
vegan.
Are
they, like, verified by Belgians or?
I don't know. Catalan farmers verify them. They're like
verification check mark.
They're big. There's a cobblestone climb just here next to my house, and it's tough. I mean, it's not pavé. So, like in so, yeah. I know what a cobblestone is, Benji.
I was hoping that my benefit would be that I've ridden on them, so I'm more prepared for, like, the pain in my arms and so forth. Because
doing sectors like in Roubaix or Flanders. No, I've never done that. So yeah, and I'm a small guy, so maybe I won't. Maybe my old dislocated shoulder, you know, old war wounds comes to the front. Speaking of Miss Cobblestones, the last race to recap was GP Cliquillon. I don't even know whether this exists or not, but I like Alex Segaard. He won with Henry Uhlig hacking with him. So that was another race with some young guns doing well.
You're acting like this is one of those imaginary championships that a country made for UCI points.
Turkmenistan champ may as well be.
Yeah, Cliquillon was won by Alex Segaard, won from the wheel of Henry Uhlig, who rode a bit too long with Alex Segaard in the wheel without really wanting Segaard to take over, and that resulted in Segaard winning just ahead of the peloton. GP Montserrat today then was basically once again ending up in a reduced sprint where Jarno van der Paar from Lotto won, the young guy that did top 10s in UAE Tour, because Milan Menten crashed out, the other sprinter that was likely to be the main guy is what I would expect, but van der Paar solved it himself, so that's the winner for that. And that's it for the ChatGPT races too, so we can head into the preview, starting with Paris-Nice, which we just had the first stage of, like we already mentioned. And stage two is looking like a flat stage on paper, but in my head, first stage in Paris-Nice are echelon, you know?
Yeah, this is supposed to be that stage, and you might be listening to this during this stage, because we'll upload this on Monday. We're recording this Sunday night, but yeah, the forecast is headwind. And or even 12 km/h an hour wind. So that's not gonna quite get it done. So that's probably a relief for the UAE guys.
Yep.
And maybe sad news for Jorgensen, I would say, in terms of GC. On stage three, we have from Auxerre to Auxerre. It's a team time trial, a hilly one too, 27 km long, and they're keeping the funny rule they launched last year, where the TTT time is set by the first rider of yours that crosses the line, not the fourth. So basically, Quickstep can launch Remco with 1 km to go, and he can do like a full gas sprint to the line. I can't wait for Coy. I was just thinking, what if Coy is still in the leader's jersey after stage two?
It's possible, but I wouldn't. It's a sacrifice you have to make.
Yeah.
You got to sacrifice Coy there. But that being said, UAE team members can't sacrifice five of their 5 liters.
True. McNulty, because McNulty's the best time trialist here. Then Vine's also really good. They're all three of them good TTs riders. Finn's probably the one at risk. Although, wait, no, but he gets... Hold on, Luke's going to have to confirm for us.
We'll confirm what?
Finn gets McNulty's time when McNulty crosses the line first, right? Or does he get his own time?
Gets his own time.
Holy shit, dude.
Isn't that the rule?
He gets his own.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's the joke I was making.
How are they going to do it?
That's my point.
They're probably all four of them really strong guys, and Pollitt too, and who else they got here?
They'll just keep riding with four till the line, I bet you.
I think that's the only way to do it, really. Like, if the strongest one should just take longer pulls.
Wait, until the last kilometer, and then it's a 1v1v1v1.
Soler there. Maybe Soler just attacks them all and says, hey, I already won it. I'm the only one of you all that's won this race on GC.
Holy crap, memories.
Yeah, think about it for a second. But I can't wait. I actually like that rule. I wouldn't like it in every TT because it is a bit of a gimmick, but for one off, it's kind of fun to watch and give something
put
to
it in the tour. for the memes.
Yeah, sure, sure. What stage? Stage 4 is from Chalon-sur-Saône to Mont-Bruy, 183.5 kilometers. This stage, I think, is based on what we saw today in Stage 1. This is a difficult stage. Up and down all day with medium mountain climbs. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to call them medium mountains or hills. I'm calling them medium mountains. And then we have the two last climbs, 5K, 7%. There's also a bonus sprint before then on a 1,300 meter 5% climb. And then it finishes on Mont-Bruy, 3K, 7.7%. This is like a Roglic stage from way back. He's got Vlasov here to lead him out. But Remco is good on these finishes too. So I'm really looking forward to this finish, Benji.
Yep.
Even Finn Fisher Black and the UAE guys are very good on this finish. So I think this will be an exciting stage.
Yeah, and at this point, we might have a view of who the UAE leaders are by the end of Stage 4, hopefully. But Stage 5, then we look at a 194-kilometer stage. And this is an interesting one to me because there's a lot of climbs in there. And when I look at the parkour, they're not exactly very hard. It's really weird to classify the stage. Could a break win? No.
Yeah, break stage.
That's my initial thought because, like, when I look at the percentage, I'm like, Mats Pedersen, but there's too many climbs.
Oh, he can get around it.
Really?
Yeah. He's climbing really well. He's climbing really, really well. But
not impossible.
Whether his team can control the stage is another question.
Breakaway, Pedersen?
Yes, that's also an option. But I like Jordan Jagat on Total or Bergodo on Total. They'll be getting in the break for sure.
Yeah.
Ineos also let Frehler in the break or Tarling or somebody. Let him in the break. Come on. And same with, I'd like to see Pithy in this break too as well. I think he can, this should be a break stage. Stage 6 is, again, a tricky one. These are long stages, aren't they? Two back-to-back 200K stages from Sisteron to La Corse Loop. It's up and down all day. No real serious climb except the Côte de la Col sur Loup, 2Ks, 10%, just after the finish line when they go through it the first time, and it keeps going up afterwards. This looks like, I reckon Remco's going to kick off here and try to take some time, is what I would guess, and Roglic will sit on his wheel, and Remco will get mad, is my prediction. Stage 7 from Nice to Auron is the high mountain stage. Bear in mind, it just snowed a lot on Auron, but it's soft mountains. Like La Colmienne, 7Ks, 7%, then another very gradual climb, and then Auron is 7Ks, 7%. That's like a Roglic climb for sure. And then the last stage from Nice to Nice is, to me, the real GC stage.
Yep.
With proper hard climbs, including the Col de Quatre Chemins, 4Ks, 8%, 10Ks cresting from Nice. What do you see for this week, Benji?
I think for the final stage, the key is simple. If you're Remco, make the stage as hard as possible because that stage in the past has given Roglic nightmares if it's opened up early. And he usually was responsible for opening up early with his team. So it's that's the vibe I'm getting from that. We're going to have a good fight between Remco, Roglic, and perhaps some other ones in GC. I'm curious what a Jorgensen will do in GC. I'm curious where the UAE boys are at when it comes to their form against those riders, what they'll do in the TT, if we can see Paranese go do again. I've got so many questions. Bernal, for example, what will Felix Gall do? Is his TTT going to be somewhat okay? His climbing, what can we expect from that now that he has a proper bike as well? Questions.
Yeah, it's a lot of good GC riders here. I'm particularly keen to see how Bora and Roglic set up for many stages, which really, like, this is a beautiful parkour for Roglic. Like, as a one-week race,
yep,
a really good parkour for him. I question whether the mountain stage on stage 7 will happen in full. And then I want to see Remco and his team execute a plan. Not just, Bernal attack, let me attack. Oh, Sturven's attacking, let me follow follow Sturven on the flat. Execute a plan. And how's he going to win this race? Maybe he's just going to take time in the TTT and defend, but I don't think he'll do that. I think he'll be on the aggressive. So I think it's going to be a great week of racing minus the crosswinds where you are hopefully expecting or hoping for. They don't look like they're going to eventuate.
I feel like if you take a look at Remco versus Roglic, the real only stage where I see Roglic potentially taking time on Remco is on Oran, you know? And it's not really hard enough either to take much time.
Yeah. I honestly think Boris should play Vlasov because he looked good today and force Remco to do something is what I would do. Because you can't be sure that Roglic is going to beat him even on Mont Bruy. Remco's got great punch. So,
Van Wilder v. Vlasov, who do you take?
Vlasov.
Probably.
That's uncharitable to Van Wilder. He made that group today. So,
well,
Eitor
was good as well, eh?
Yeah. Actually, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to pick Remco to win GC, though. But I think there'll be some fireworks along the way.
I think so as well. And that brings us to Tirreno Adriatico, where the start lists, the most important names for me are not even just GC. I'm looking at the sprinters, Philipsen versus Melier. Yeah. But we're not starting off with a sprint. We've got a Toledo di Camaiore TT again, right?
Yep. Yeah, this is the Ghana 10K TT that usually cleans up, and he's back here to defend his crown on the coast. So I don't see anyone on this start list that should threaten him, frankly.
I think so too.
Yeah.
I'm looking through this.
There's no Remco, no Tarling.
But then again,
no Van Aert.
His TT was pretty bad 2 weeks ago. So should we be worried?
Yeah, I would never bet against him in this TT. Because I did it before many years ago. I think 4 years ago.
Yeah. You were never sad as much as that day.
Stage two, sprint stage, and that's what I'm really keen to see. Cavendish is here as well. Can they get it right? Yeah. Even though they sent Selig, and so part of his train is in Paris-Nice. Very strange. The scheduling of Astana, very, very strange. That Scaroni didn't do Strada, I don't think, and is doing Paris-Nice, for example, after being so good in Trofeo Laguelia.
Yeah.
No Welsford. Binny's here. But yeah, I just want to see Philipsen Melier. That's all I want to see. Yep. Stage three, looks like Philipsen can get around it, but there is like an uphill kick. Long stage, 224Ks. Could be a break, honestly. Like a lot of teams should go for the break here and really go for it. Stage four is another. Could be a break. Could be a sprint. It's got a long climb in the first. It's like a classic Giro stage. They got like an 18K, 5% climb.
More should be sprints, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at this quick step. Alfonsen De Koenig team, Conchi, Gergel, Rizabic, they can control those hilly stages, I think. And then stage five is the first possible GC day, Benji, although it is up and down, 144 kilometers long with a 12-kilometer 6% climb, 24Ks from the finish, as well as a 2K kicker after that, about 7Ks from the finish. Do you reckon this is GC possibly?
It's possibly GC, but I'm not very hyped about the percentage of Gian Giacomo for major selectiveness to the point that is it then a risk to attack on the San Giacomo climb, which is like the climb starts with 40K to go. It's for 12 kilometers uphill, 12 kilometers downhill, and the rest is like 11 kilometers to the finish line, slightly uphill. So you're risking attacking on the climb and then a group behind you trying to chase you back in the last 11 kilometers, which I don't know. Vingegaard might risk it because let's be honest about it. He's not. Yeah, he's against proper competition, but he should still beat them all.
It's a very, very regular climb. Like it really is 6% for most of it. And it levels off near the top two. So
is it worth the risk?
If I'm looking at this start list, you got Martinez, Hindley, Kemner. I don't expect all three of them to full drop on that climb. So then you could have a problematic valley afterwards. Where Arensman, Pidcock are moving. And so I think having numbers deep into that stage, if it does kick off on GC, will be very, very important. Yep. Stage six is a very different scenario. It's like hills all day, not so much flat, 180 kilometers long, and then the piece de resistance and the main GC part of this whole Tirreno Adriatico is the 10-kilometer, 8% climb. And the first 5Ks are really quite steep, around 9%, I think, from memory. It also starts uphill. So this is, without a doubt, a GC day, and the best should really rise to the top. I don't see too many tactics being involved here either, because say, yeah, like Dylan Van Baarle and Robert Gesink, you can have a satellite rider, but they're not going to get much of a leash, I don't think, on that sort of contour.
Jonas Vingegaard should clean GC here. Like,
yeah, he should. Anything less than winning is a disappointment.
Exactly. Then the next stage is that typical San Benedetto del Tronto sprint stage. Hills in the first half, but the second half is completely flat. Bit of a circuit kind of vibe in San Benedetto del Tronto. And is this a stage that Bauhaus
won? Yeah, give me Phil Bauhaus for this bad boy. He's here too with the German.
Oh, no.
No, Sutherland. But yeah, other GC contenders that I haven't mentioned include Ayuso on UAE. Yates isn't starting because of his concussion in the UAE Tour, unfortunately. Gagan Hart, after starting well in Valencia, don't know. He's here with Milan for the sprints.
Algarve.
Chris Froome, obviously the GC favorite. And Carapaz, Mark Padun on Corotec. Ewan for the sprints. I want to see maybe Ewan snags one. And Pozzovivo also makes his start for Bardiani, his first race for them after his transfer or signing for them got approved. My dark horse for this is Tiberi podium on GC.
I think it's not impossible, but I'm also not sure about podium yet. I think top five, kind of like the Fabro vibe on that Tirreno climb a few years ago. But Tiberi can hold it in GC.
I'm just going off the UAE Tour ITT, where Bahrain came 5th, 7th, and 8th on a flat, fast TT. Yeah. Maybe their TT setup isn't so dog shit anymore, and he should do a good TT.
Yep.
So that's, and then maybe he's a steady climber, good on Angleroo. So that's that stage. So yeah, I also don't think the GC field is so
like
deep
it.
Here. Yeah. Who have you got? Vingegaard winning GC?
Yeah, he should clean GC. As simple as that. And yep. I'm way more curious about the sprints between Melier and Philipsen than I am for GC, actually.
And Cav and Ewan. But yeah, I also agree. It's Melier and Philipsen's a really mouth-watering prospect in those. And there should be a few sprints for them. So two great races on this week. I guess it's a shame they overlap, but we will have pod recaps every day after Torino-Adriatico. Because normally that finishes about 45 minutes later than Paris-Nice from memory. They don't quite overlap the finishes, at least. I hope not.
Correct.
They're the main two races on this week. In terms of a quick recap of the UCI points, Benji, there's an article up on LanternRouge.com up to date to this weekend. Did you know that Decathlon are ahead of Visma on the 2024 points ranking?
Well, I read the article and then I realized that they were ahead of that. Like, there's quite a few.
I'm going to get fired, dude.
No, mate, they've been doing really well and O'Connor doing well. And then it's mainly like those close spots in the one-day races that also added
Benoit
to it from my memory. Tronchon, for example. Prodhomme, if I recall, also pretty close.
Yeah.
Baudin in that one GP Marseillaise race. There's just so many 1.1 races and like small races and even in Omloop, Nassen, for example, that they got close in that it ends up mattering. Cosne-Franstrade, like you said. So we're looking at a lot of points there, and there's quite a few teams like that have made a lot of points. And it's curious. The curious part about the article for me is as well that Santos Sudenander gives a shitload of points.
Yeah, it's a World Tour GC.
Is it
but
too
you,
much?
You have to, but you have to reward the teams that send a rider out there to win it. That's the whole thing, you know? Like, otherwise, if you don't give points for Cadells and TDU, then you're really, then you're just going to send the shittest team possible, unless an Australian really wants to do it. But
Narvaez is on top of the ranking right now.
But that's from Pan American Games is included in that. He won the road race end of last year, which was like 250 points, the Pan American Games road race. But he's gone back to Ecuador. So I don't know what the hell's going on there. Flying. They got the Cobble Classics and Paris-Nice, and he went back to Ecuador. It doesn't make much sense to me. But UAE predictably are leading with like a 1,500-point margin, which is literally they got a 50% gap to second already 2 months into the year. They're going to run away with the points competition in 24. Yeah. They're going to win easily.
They
go to every race, man. They're even sending people... And like Morgado with the dev guys to Le Sommet.
Mate, Del Toro has like so many races already. He's now doing Well, is he Pyrenees doing, or was it Tirreno?
Tirreno.
He's done so many races already. I'm like worried that they're overburdening these youngsters.
13 days.
It feels more in my head. Because it's a longer time span, because he started in STDU.
That's the thing. It is like over a 2 month period. I don't think it's too bad. And they are using that dev team cleverly, where they basically send to Le Sommet. They get Morgado. It might have even been the dev team that raced there, but they get him a good racing opportunity as a leader, as a Neo Pro to race for the win himself after pulling for Wellens and Omloop on Saturday. I think that's really smart.
And then when it comes to like the wildcard point system, you've got Lotto and Israel that are running away from the rest. So we've got those like virtually securing the wildcards to Welter events in 2025.
Lotto for sure. Israel, yes, but not as sure as Lotto.
I agree. And the light point when it comes to Lotto is as well that De Lee's not really scoring much at all so far. No. So it's all coming from Van Gils, Van Eetveld, Van der Paar, Alex Segaard. It's coming from all Boomens. These like riders. It's not a one-man army this year, which is very positive for the future of these points.
Exactly. So yeah, that's Lotto Destiny are completely fine. They're going to be promoted. Israel, yeah, like if they lose Corbin Strong in the transfer market, I don't know if Stephen Williams is out of contract and other. It's less sure, but the benefit for them is Arkea and Astana don't look good at all. Astana, I think, have no chance. Like, they're not scheduling correctly. They signed a sprint train with Cavendish. I like Scaroni, Velasco, Gazzoli.
Facts.
But they're not being sent to the perfect schedule, and Astana really look like they have no chance, especially with Lutsenko not being a big scorer, really. And Arkea, they'll need Cofidis to be really shit. In terms of the wild cards and the proteins for next year, Tudor have started really, really well, and that's no surprise. They spent a lot of money on new signings like Trentin, established winners, and they are now currently are sitting in the wild card to the one-day race slot. So there's Lotto in Israel. Currently, they get all the wild cards for all the World Tour events in 25, as it stands. And then there's a third, whoever's third in the pro team ranking gets all the wild cards to the one-day World Tour races. Tudor is there 500 points ahead of UnoX. So UnoX, they got to do something, Benji. Their scheduling is bad. Their signings are scoring no points. Leknesund has 10 race days, zero UCI points. The new signing. Court was never going to be a big point scorer. Søren Warenskjold is doing Tirreno Adriatico. He has 22 UCI points in 9 race days. The guys should be in decent shape, but he should be doing all the ChatGPT races.
Yeah, he did. Listen, man, but I was expecting him to see him at Criculeon, at, for example, Monster, at all these races, because that's where a Warenskjold can take those points. And in a Tirreno, he's not going to do that. There he's probably together with Christoph for a sprint train.
Yeah. But like against the sprinters there. And even if you come fourth or third at an overperformance, it's no points.
Even Christoph should be doing the 1.1 race at this point.
He should be. And he's on a big contract probably. So, and even the tactics when they do the one races, they had Rasmus Tiller, Søren Warenskjold, and Bloom and other guys, Adler Samar, they opened the race. They had four guys leading up the hill with like 3 laps to go. I'm like, oh, they're going to open it. They're going to do Jumbo. They're going to do Visma Lease bike tactics. They're going to get Tiller and Warenskjold in a group and work them and then get two in the top five and win. And then they just stopped. And then they ended up starting a lead out train with 2.5Ks to go with two riders or three riders, got washed over, and Tiller came fifth. And Warenskjold and no one else scored any points. I was like, it was terrible. So that they're in, not only are they not looking good for promotion in 26, UnoX, unfortunately for them, are not looking good at the moment. It can change quickly. 500 points is not that big, but not looking good for even the wildcards, the one day World Tour races. And I wonder if even if two to get really good Benji, whether the ASO then now there's a competitor for the discretionary French wildcards from ASO. Yeah.
But when it comes to wildcards, it's also partially the, we call that France politics. In you're not going to tell me that the fact that Tudor is becoming a sponsor of Flanders Classics is having zero influence on their wildcards there.
Are they sponsor of Flanders Classics?
Yeah.
Can they get the photo finishes a bit quicker? Or the timing? I swear the UAE timing, UAE tour timing, where they're sponsored, took about an hour for a basic stage to get the,
yeah,
other than the top 10. But okay. Wait, so that's Tudor that's doing Flanders Classics, not...
Yeah, yeah.
They're going to get all the free wildcards. I hope it's a one-year contract, because if they get the free wildcards next year, you don't have to pay the sponsorship. You get the entry guaranteed. Go check out that article if you want to see all the stats in more detail. We have a bit of an update on the one cycling project. It really, to me, every week that a new article comes out, the project sounds more dead in the water. But that doesn't mean people aren't doing things behind closed doors. But it really, what people are saying, it doesn't look promising. This L'Equipe has an article about it, and one of the quotes from that is on the one cycling project. There was a €250 million Saudi offer, but they wanted a return that could just be revenue of at least €100 million in the first year or in a year. And if this didn't happen, they'd like the member teams to make up any shortfall. So, like, imagine I don't know what Soudal is. You're a local Belgian grouting manufacturer, or you're a flooring manufacturer for the Benelux market. And all of a sudden, the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund says, can you guarantee us, you're a 10% shareholder in this, can you guarantee us 10 mil per year revenue? And they're like, brother, we can't guarantee 10 mil to this team ourselves.
It makes me think, like, man, you said it at the start. The more you hear about this, the worse it sounds. Then you start to wonder if it's truly what is happening behind the scenes, or whether this is like a rumor that came out that eventually led to a newspaper publishing this. But
L'Equipe's owned by ASO Group, right?
Yeah, that's the advocate of the devil thing I was going to say. L'Equipe is owned by ASO. Are they fully neutral in this situation?
No. But ASO were basically laughing at it.
Yeah.
Prudhomme was basically laughing at it. This article's... But why would they know the details if they've been cut out? They might not know the details of what's going on. But yeah, I think what happens is everyone's like, there's so much money in cycling, so much untapped potential. And, you know, ASO, they hoard all this money and they got this pile of gold, right? And then they do the project and then they're like, actually, how are we going to generate 100 mil a year out of this?
No clue how that's possible.
It starts to fall down a little bit, perhaps. Maybe it's just a rumor, but as Luke said, it could be the French teams involved are leaking to L'Equipe as well. That could be the source for this. But making 100 mil a year without the Tour de France in your portfolio, I mean, good luck. I don't know if the Tour isn't on the table where there's the big broadcast rights. Even if you have the Giro, I don't know what the Giro worldwide broadcast rights fee would be. No way it's...
Can't be that much.
No way it's 100 mil.
No, for sure it isn't.
No. And that's the biggest other property that could be involved. No, and RCS are out, aren't they? It's just Flanders Classics.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, Tour of Flanders, lovely race and all, but...
hey. Well, at least worth 100 million.
Yeah, maybe the Belgians. But yeah, that's just a little update on that one.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Our next segment now, we're going to talk about hookless rims. I'm mainly doing this selfishly because I have hookless rims and they're like first gen ones, the Calendar Giant TCR in like 2019, the Advanced Pro on the Giant rims. And I basically want to know if they're safe or not because Thomas de Gendt, he crashed in UAE Tour, foam insert, whole tire comes off the rim, hookless rims blamed. And then the UCI has released a statement saying in light of a series of recent events, they're going to investigate as a matter of urgency to study the situation to make a rapid decision in the interest of rider safety. And Escape Collective reported that de Gendt rode with tires which were 1 millimeter below rim requirements for those particular hookless rims.
Yeah. Question before we jump into the discussion. Has this happened to anyone outside of Lotto in racing? Because I only remember de Gendt and the lead during that sprint where he had his wheel destroyed.
I swear there was another one in the last 2 days.
Don't remember.
But it might have been another Lotto rider. So yeah, if they're just riding with it out of spec, then it's kind of a Lotto problem. But there was there's been a few tires rolling off rims. Not the Gendt wasn't the first one. I'm not sure if they're all hookless. But I was shocked when I saw how low the pressure was as the max pressure on the tires when I bought them for the tubeless hookless. And like getting the compatible tires is all a bit of a nightmare. So we're bringing in Alex, bringing in an expert because me and Benji, as you can tell, don't know much about this technical stuff.
Treat us like the Philistines we are, Alex. What is a hookless rim and what is a hooked rim?
Okay, first and foremost, I probably will get confused with hookless and hooked just because I've been saying it so much recently. But intrinsically, they're very similar. The only difference is right at the top edge of the sidewall, on a hooked rim, which is the traditional one which we've had since you can probably remember, you know, starting cycling, has a tiny little hook, an extra bit of material coming out sideways on the inside of the sidewall to clinch the tire. That's essentially where clinchers came from, because they clinch onto that little hook, and it's just an extra part of the rim structure to prevent the tire blowing off. Now, you really, in theory, shouldn't need them, because yes, lots of other vehicles out there on the road don't use hooked rims, so cars, truck tires, things like this. But when we talk about dimensions in a little bit, you'll see why it's quite important in bikes to keep them. And a hookless rim has a straight sidewall without the extra little bead hook on the inside of the sidewall. That's the only difference.
My question was, because I'm stupid and me and Patrick discussed this beforehand, what is the reason that you don't need that hook? Because in my head, I was like, without a hook, it will fall off, man.
Yeah. How does it stay in place?
So if we take other vehicles out there that use hookless rims, like let's say a car tire on an alloy rim, they don't come off for a number of reasons. Well, essentially the car tire is a completely different technology to a bike tire. It's a radial construction with actually steel. It's got steel beads. So the, you know, the thick bit on the bottom of the sidewall of the tire, that's the bead. There's a steel cord in that on a car tire, and that diameter of that steel cord is held very, very tightly to a tight tolerance for safety reasons. And second of all, car tire has got radial belts of sometimes steel or very, very high tensile strength fabric going across the tire underneath the tread. And that holds the diameter of the tire when it's inflated. Now, bike tires is a very old construction method called basically cross ply. And that's something we used to have in vehicles, which stopped in the 1950s. But it's much harder to control that diameter of the tire under inflation and control it in manufacture. And essentially, other vehicle tires don't come off hookless rims because the tolerances are held much, much tightly, more tightly of the rim and the tire construction. There are other differences as well, like where the mounting channel for hookless on a bicycle rim is in the center. So both beads can drop into that when they're depressurized. And that's another reason why depressurized bike tire can come off quite quickly and easily compared to a car tire, where the drop center is offset to one side. But that's that's getting into the construction of the rim a bit. But
okay, so if I'm understanding this correctly, so a hookless rim when it is in a hookless rim with a tire when it is inflated,
mm-hmm.
the problem of the tire literally just rolling off
mm-hmm.
whilst inflated is not actually the issue. It's going to stay in place when it's inflated. The difference is, or the potential problem is, when it deflates quickly with a catastrophic or not even, are you saying even with a slow leak, it's then more likely to fully roll off, like we saw with De Gendt in the UAE Tour?
I would say no, because both of those cases are true. They can just blow off under pressure, which we've seen. We've seen hookless rims on training camps pumped up to 73 PSI, left out in the sun, and bang, whilst you're eating breakfast, they're blowing off the rim
right.
without any mechanical or force input to that tire. So the hook clearly does do a job in retaining the tire under normal conditions. So hookless tires can just slide off. And that's because as the tire inflates, essentially on a road tire, the tire is quite narrow, let's say. Although tires are getting bigger, they are quite narrow. So when they inflate, the sidewalls of the tire not only go outwards, they kind of want to arc upwards as well. And they will creep up the sidewalls of the rim under high pressure. And without the little hook at the top of the rim, they can slip over.
Yeah.
And ironically, the sealant in the tire lubricates that movement of the bead up the sidewall.
Because these are always tubeless, right? Hookless is always,
yeah, they're always
tubeless.
Yeah. Well, not you don't have to run them tubeless, but most people do to get the low rolling resistance benefits and what have you. Anything wet inside the tire will lubricate that movement of the bead up the wall. I'm not saying it's a reason. I'm not saying that's the reason. It's just another factor. But without that hook on top, if there is any kind of tolerance discrepancy, if the bead of the tire is slightly too big, or it's got damaged and it's grown under pressure, then there's nothing stopping it from just popping over. And we've seen that. And in engineering, we like to have a sliding scale of safety factor. But what gets engineers in this instance is that there's a hard line at 73 PSI. And it's like, before that, you're good, no lawsuits. At 74 PSI, it's chance of death. And that doesn't work like that in science and engineering. Like, there has to be a sliding scale of risk. And there's no safety factor applied to it, it seems. So a lot of the manufacturers like to wriggle out of it and say, well, if you inflated to 74, 75 PSI on the wrong width, you know, that's your risk. But actually, there should be way more safety factor than that built in. You can take a normal GP4000, let's go back 10 years, GP4000 on a hooked rim, you can take that to 150, 160 PSI without it blowing off the rim. No one's ever going to ride it that hard, but that's the safety factor. So if you're riding at 80, you've got a safety factor of 2 if you can take it to 160 PSI. Whereas it just seems with hookless, you haven't got that big safety factor built in. So any overpressure, whether that be hot tarmac, like in the UAE, hot sun, if you've got an enclosed volume at high temperature, the pressure goes up. So are you expecting riders to monitor temperature change and pressure change in the tires? No. Where's the safety factor?
Okay.
When it comes to the safety factor there, you're talking about the tire pressure, but also when it comes to the combination of tire width versus rim width, that's something Escape Collective dove into in their article mm-hmm. about the De Gendt crash.
Yeah.
I was wondering, so for example, there's ISO standards, which is like an organization for like general standards on everything. I remember them from my dev days.
Well, all bike parts are made to. Yeah.
Okay. So there's ISO standards for every single bike part in some sense for safety reasons. And in this specific situation, there seemed to have been an offset between the rim width, tire width combination and what was said to be the correct compatibility in the ISO standard. Is that dangerous?
Yeah, for sure. But it's a bit of a joke because all bicycle parts, whether it's frames, handlebars, stems, pedals, wheels are slightly different, but they're all built to an ISO standard or above, which is ISO 42.10, I believe. And you wouldn't be seeing those frames, wheels, handlebars ridden if they hadn't surpassed that safety standard. But it seems with hookless, I always get those two confused, teams are swerving that ISO rule and going with what the tire manufacturer says or the rim manufacturer says. Now, the discrepancy with the De Gendt failure was that Zip and Vittoria, the two equipment choices that were made for that, you know, sponsor team, they were using a combination, the ISO standard says shouldn't be run. So the ISO standard states that the 29 millimeter tire should be the minimum width for that rim. And they were using a 28. But even that tiny, offset of one
it's
millimeter
barely a difference.
It's barely a difference. Is it a 28 mil tire out like on the box or 28 mil measured when it's inflated? Even, you know, if you get an old tire that's been inflated for a few thousand kilometers, they do stretch a little bit. So it's going to measure up bigger. And that one millimeter should be well within any safety factor. And the fact that we're arguing about one millimeter ain't going to change anything. Like it's, that goes to show it's intrinsically dangerous to, for me. Like,
well, that's what I found as like a consumer, because I bought a TCR, not a sponsor. I bought it, you know, this is 5 years ago before anyone, I would get anything for free. TCR Advanced Pro, great deal. And comes stock with tube. This is like, this is 2018, 19, comes stock with tubeless, hookless. And that's early doors for that, I think, on the road.
Yeah.
I couldn't find a fucking tire. Like to get it, unless then. You, like back then, to find the tire manufacturers that would actually be compatible, you couldn't find one. And even now I can barely find one that's compatible. And then you look at the tire and it's like maximum 5 bar. And like, I got no problem running 4 bar, or I used to do that one on clinches when I was light, you know, back in 2017, I would run 60 PSI back then, which was like really, really low. But I was thinking, damn, the max is 5 bar.
Yeah.
And there's all these other things about it, but it, regardless, I've not personally had any issue with it. But why is that when it started coming in? Like, when did when did hookless start coming in? Why has it come in? Who are the drivers? Is it rim manufacturers? Because it, to me, it looks like the tire manufacturers, the people having to react to this to bring out a product to fit it.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I don't think it's tire manufacturers. And I think if you really wanted to look at the seed or the inception of this, you have to go back to the early 2000s when the Taiwanese A-Team was established. Now, the A-Team was a cooperation, not in a fiscal sense, but more of a collaboration of competitors in the Taiwanese bike industry. Giant, Merida, KMC, Tektro, biggest brake manufacturer, SR Suntour, make all the suspension forks in the world. They actually got together to challenge the Chinese mainland manufacturers, because I think during about the mid-90s, the Chinese mainland manufacturers overtook Taiwan for bicycle exports. And if you look at even up to 2020, 95% of bicycle exports to North America, let's say, from mainland Chinese suppliers, not Taiwan. So Taiwan in the early 2000s had to re-strategize, and they selected the high-end road bike and mountain bike market to keep that as their baby. They wanted to keep that mantle. They, like I said, they didn't merge, but they came together in this cooperation, this collaborative agreement to share suppliers and get suppliers involved in the R&D phase. That's upstream and downstream. They produced an ERP system, which is enterprise resource planning, MRP, manufacturing resource planning. And they've really streamlined the whole outfit for high-end products, road and mountain bike. And that lasted until about 2016, when it formally stopped being this agreement. But many of the principles became established, and actually took a lot of principles from Toyota, the automotive world. So the Kaizen and the Kanban way of manufacturing stuff came into the bike industry. And Giant has such a high output of frames, wheels, products, components in Taiwan. It's simply not feasible for them to produce hooked rims, because with hooked rims, there is intrinsically more scrap, more wastage, a lower yield, and it's less efficient, because it's really quite hard to actually mold a hook onto a carbon rim in the current way that we've been doing it for like 20 years. Right. And this is... although, you know, SRAM Taiwan, subsidiary of SRAM LLC, was not directly part of this collaborative A-Team in Taiwan, they were certainly using suppliers that were. So a lot of learnings from SRAM Taiwan came into SRAM America, where Zip rims are made. So Zip rims, like Degent rims, let's say, Zip and Envy make rims in North America. They could not feasibly make hooked rims in North America because of the wastage. So I'm not saying that one in every two hooked rims that comes out of the mold is scrap, but there is certainly a lower yield making hooked rims than hookless.
But they did it before.
They did it before. They did it before, but I think with the higher throughput that they needed, and obviously having labor rates in the US not being the cheapest, not being as cheap as mainland China, it's from, you know, I'm an engineer. If I was making stuff in North America, would I want something that was potentially going to, let's say I got my hooked rim out of the hot press mold. There's maybe 3 to 4 hours of man labor before that stage. So cutting, preforming the pre-preg carbon fiber to go into the mold. If I pull that out of a hot mold in and the hook is damaged, which can happen because it's quite hard, they're very small, they're quite fragile at that point. If there's a void or an air bubble or the hook is damaged, I can't afford to scrap 2 to 4 hours of US labor rate and just throw it in the bin.
Yeah.
And it's not just the labor rate, it's the obviously the material costs, which probably is not as expensive as the labor, but you've got the fractional machine time, the manufacturing time. I can't afford to have a lower yield than I could with hookless. So I'm going to go to hookless. And I don't blame the manufacturers for doing it. It's, you know, people use lean manufacturing. It's a bit of a buzzword, but if you've got any common sense, everyone does lean manufacturing. It's just you don't want scrap. You don't want wastage. You want the most efficient for the product. And the thing is with hookless, it is alienating the very high kind of top-end performance echelon of the sport. But if you're alienating 5% of your customer base, but you're saving 20%, do that. I feel that's how it's going.
And so this isn't, having sort of lived through all of us, you know, the disc versus rim break, it's a conspiracy that Big Road is trying to force disc break on us. Well, they did, but also, you know, disc breaks have a lot of benefits as well. Is this sort of in that line as well, but it's not even less, it's not, there's no conspiracy at all. It literally is like what's the counter argument? Because with disc brake, it's like, well, you can actually, in the wet, there's a great benefit in the wet. You can stop your bike now. What's the argument for hookless?
So the pros and cons of, the pros and cons of hookless versus hooked is that the pros of hookless are the manufacturing cons of hooked. But from a user point of view, for me, there's no benefit.
Okay. Like
they talk about, for me, the marketing claims of hookless are more kind of cover-ups for the benefit, you know, of making them. So they talk about a better tire to rim transition. So for better aerodynamics.
Right.
But speaking to my old mate, Dan Bigham, he was pretty bummed when they stopped making rim brake wheels because he said the rim brake track was good for aerodynamics. That little trip where you get the rim brake track, he said that was great. And they had to work really hard when they lost that and went to disc brake carbon wheels. So it's not as simple as just making it smoother transition. Hashtag can't see aero. But yeah. It's from a user point of view, there are no benefits. I mean, there is a, because of the way it's molded, and I do have a video coming out on this, shameless plug, but
Plug away.
Probably a couple of days after this goes out, I'll have my video. It's already live on Patreon. Another plug, but it'll be coming out. But basically, molding a hook into the sidewall is very, very tricky because you have to take continuous sheets of prepreg carbon fiber, go up the sidewall, wrap it around the top, make the hook shape, and bring it down again with no voids, no air bubbles, and no structural defects. And that's really hard to do, to compression mold that, because this piece isn't blown up by one of the airbags. It's just compression molded by the segments of the steel tool. And you are going to get a stronger sidewall with hookless. It's more uniform structure. There's less stress raises. It's going to be slightly stronger in the sidewall. That, if you consider that a user benefit, probably yes. If you're talking about like gravel rims or mountain bike rims, you want a stronger sidewall. But on road, where we're not riding through potholes and craters, I don't think it's a massive gain just to have a stronger sidewall because, you know, hooked rims have been strong enough in impact because they passed the UCI drop test, which admittedly isn't very harsh.
So what happens now with the UCI? They say they're investigating it. What do you think that entails? And then what do you think is going to happen? I saw Bigham said history is not going to be kind to hookless. What do you think happens now?
I think they need to really limit the tire size. So if you're using a very wide internal rim, like the zips of 25 mil or 23 mil, to make that safe in the time being, like in the meantime, whilst they're investigating whether they want to do it or not, I would stipulate that everyone has to be on like a 30 mil tire, because when you start getting narrow with the tire closer to the internal rim width of the rim, that's when it starts to get dicey. If you go up to a much bigger tire, you'll never have a problem with hookless. And you've seen that on mountain bikes and gravel bikes.
Right.
And it does seem like the trend is, if you're way over the internal width with the tire, whether that's a 35 mil cyclocross tire or 40 mil gravel tire, rarely have a problem. It's when you start coming down to road sizes with a very wide internal rim, that's when you've got a problem. So I think if they want to make it safe in the meantime, they need to say, right, for hookless, 20, 23 mil internal max and 28 mil tire minimum. That, I think, would be the absolute minimum.
And that's because with the wider tire, it blows out, and there's that, what then, horizontal pressure against the sidewall from the wider tire.
Yeah. I mean, if you can imagine if you talk about the extremes, if you imagine a very, very, very narrow tire and a very wide rim.
Yeah, yeah.
As it pressurizes, the sidewalls want to arc upwards more. So the pressure actually affects the bead differently as it does on a wider tire.
Okay.
But if we were prepared to ride, you remember if you go into like a cheap bike shop and you buy the cheapest tire on the rack, it's not folding. It's got steel bead running around it, and it's not a folding tire. If we were prepared to use those, I think everyone would be better off on hookless, because they're a lot stronger.
It's not
they
fast.
Can't grow. It's not fast, and they can't grow so much, right? They can't, with that steel bead in there. It's harder to damage that than it is a Kevlar bead, which is what the folding tires have. And yeah, but no one's going to ride those. So,
but do you think a full ban is realistic? I don't see it, because the manufacturers, this is the way they're going. Yeah. It's already being used so widely. And also, to play devil's advocate, riders have had mystery crashes for eons where they're riding along and just that something blows up or their bike collapses. I wouldn't say there's been a full analysis of like crashes related to hookless the pro peloton. Maybe that's what the UCI is beginning to do, but they say that they're urgently looking into it. But yeah, I think this is the way it's going. And
yeah, I mean I've got a question for Thomas de Gendt. So let's say he did follow the ISO or the ETRTO specification, and he was on a 20 mil tire, which ironically Vittoria don't even make. Is that 1 millimeter bigger tire going to give him like total confidence then? Of course not. It's not like a step change in safety where you go from 28 to 29. You're like, oh, I'm safe now. Like I said, it's a sliding scale of safety factor. These things all have a relationship, whether it's linear or square or whatever. It's still, it's not you're crossing a line where you're completely safe. So the whole 5 bar 73 PSI thing needs to be looked at. And I think the ETRTO still haven't really done it properly. I think they need to come out with a much bigger, like a stronger narrative and say, right, we want a proper safety factor of at least 2. And if they did say that, crikey, you're probably only riding 2 or 3 bar at the moment.
Yeah. So more realistic is going to be a stronger set of standards and coming out, and then probably teams will be like, oh, well, now we'll go slower. And the sad reality is a lot of pros will just be like, give me the thing that's fastest.
Yeah.
As well, there's that mentality as well. I'll just take whatever's fastest because they want to win. And they don't want to, like, you can say to a pro, even with puncture risk, you're like 3 times more likely to puncture with this, but you'll save 5 watts. They'll take the 5 watts every time. Anyway, when the UCR, whatever thing they hand down comes out, we'll have to get you back on to analyze it. This has been really, really interesting for us, because we don't know really anything about the technical specifications. So as Alex said, go check out the Peak Talk YouTube channel. He's got much more in-depth videos on these subjects coming out in a couple of days, as well as other engineering subjects in bikes, which I like watching and looking at, particularly the new Favero one I checked out actually in the last couple of days. So thanks very much for coming on, Alex. And no worries. hopefully hopefully the riders stay safe and that there's some sort of solution reached where everyone can stay safe. We'll see what the UCI says. Hope you enjoyed that discussion with Alex from Peak Talk. Make sure you go check out his YouTube channel where he goes and deep dives into all things tech like that. I really like watching that sort of content because, yeah, it's not my wheelhouse, but I am interested in it. Now we're going to talk about extensions. A lot of extension news the last week or so. Let's go Riolini, Benji. Unsurprisingly, though, but she extends with Little Trek through 2027.
Like, I think it's a good decision.
Long contract for women's cycling, though. It's pretty positive.
It is, and I like seeing those longer contracts combined. We've had seen the same with, I think, Femme Van Empel in the past already, and it's quite a few female cyclists that now have a longer contract to 2027, 2026, 2028, which is a positive thing for the sport. I enjoy seeing Gaia Riolini get that because she is one of the best climbers in the peloton, despite not having the start to the season that I might have expected from Gaia Riolini, but she's not the ideal GC rider when it comes to her abilities, as in she's a great climber, but when it comes to TT, when it comes to descending, and when it comes to flat riding, there's vulnerabilities there, but that doesn't make her a very special rider that's going to win loads of stuff in the future. So I think that's a good extension. I'm extremely curious what contracts like that in value look like compared to a few years ago in women's cycling, because I would expect that there's significant rise in the value already of those contracts in the last few years. And Trek's also one of those teams that has that same base salary as they have on the men's side, no?
Yeah, I think they, Jayco, a few other teams have had that for a number of years. Trek might have even been one of the first with that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really good. And obviously they got money on board, and it's good to see it hopefully being splashed around in the women's team, and certainly the women's team started the season well. So it really needs a big talent. Of course, she's very small, but which I mentioned because descents, the flat, yep, she can be put under pressure there. It is a big disadvantage on a lot of terrain, but when the road goes really uphill, she is lethal. We saw on Covadonga last year, and I cannot wait to see her do her thing in the Tour de France Femme mountain stages this year, because there's some really tough mountain stages there, and I think she can kill it. She just needs a team around her, needs support, and maybe, yeah, I don't know, like, she's just a great rider. She won this week as well, I think, in a small Italian race. Also Trek news, Matteo Schellmoser extends to the end of 2026. He says, for me right now, I couldn't imagine being in a better place. He's been with the team for the best part of 4 years, and is the Danish national champion, is obviously, I think, said having Pedersen in the team played a big role with him, and he's just improved, yep, steadily. He won the Tour de Suisse last year. He came second in Flèche. He's just become an all-round really, really good rider, and I think they got to keep a rider like that, really. Like, they don't have that many good GC guys, and he's young.
Yeah, I think it's a good option in the team. And it's also like some of the riders they do have that were GC riders like that in the past, like a Mollema, are not that anymore. So you've got Schellmoser stepping up. And I think we hit him quite a bit for the Tour de France last year, where he wasn't there in like the bigger mountains. But I vaguely remember there being an illness or some sort of in that race as well for him. So I'm not sure how much that influenced those races, those stages. So maybe if that's influenced by injury or by illness, then towards this year, I'm looking at, can he make the next step forward, which is consistency in Grand Tours. That could lead him to that top 10 position where he can stay in from that point onward. So I think the potential is there 100%. Then that's the case with most of these riders that have their extensions. Like, the next one is Magnus Sheffield on Ineos. He's extended until the end of 2026, which he's one of those riders where he won Brabant Appel. Yep. I think last year?
No,
the year before.
Before.
I feel like my head felt like it was still 2023 for a second there, but it's 2024, so 2 years ago. He's also got loads of potential. He's a magnificent time trialist. He's versatile, so he can do stuff on other terrains, although I feel like I need to see that other terrain step up a little, because in the last year, it's been mostly the time trials that I've really seen Magnus Sheffield shine in, I would say. What do you feel like when it comes to his next step?
I would turn him into a pure GC rider. I know he can be good in the classics, yeah, and the Ardennes, fine, but the handling is a problem and the positioning is a problem. Now, maybe you could say, well, if he does all the classics, he'll get good at them. So I can understand that argument, but G never did. And so I think he's a GC prospect. He has a massive TT, a massive engine. He's only 21 years old. And what did he do? He came... Yeah, I think they need GC riders. They need young GC riders. And in Tour de Suisse, he was looking really, really good. I want to see him do that.
On one end, I agree, but I also feel like when it comes to Hayter, when it comes to Sheffield, they've tried to make Hayter a GC rider in certain races, as in they've tried to go for GC with him. And in an Algarve, that could work. But then in like the proper GC races outside of a Polonia and so forth, it never really came out. And I'm worried that their hunt for the GC rider in those riders prevents them from winning the races that they could already win at that point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and like he's... To compete with the other guys, he's like 6-7 kilos off. And maybe it's not possible to get there if his PCS weight is correct. Like realistically, if you're over 70 kilos, like you can't compete with Pogacar, Remco, Roglic, Jonas in GC. Not even close. Like it's not possible on proper mountaintop finishes. Even in Paris-Nice on like a 3K, 3.5K, 8% climb on Mont Bruit, like those guys, if they're 63, 65 kilos, it's just such a disadvantage. Because also they TT well. That's the thing. That's the difference between 25 years ago or even Wiggins TT brilliantly. And then Quintana's, you know, got a sail set on his saddle or something. He's doing a TT on backwards. So that doesn't happen anymore. So, mate, I don't know. I don't know the numbers. I don't know all the data. I don't know. I don't even know if that PCS weight is correct. But I think Sheffield's a huge talent. And more importantly, I think it's positive that March 1 or before, Ineos has announced a signing of a big talent through 26. I felt like last year, we didn't hear anything. It was all a mess. Riders were leaving. The Rodriguez side, like, this is like what should have happened with Carlos last year, right?
Progress.
So they've done the right thing. You have to extend him. He's a big talent.
Next up, one,
Goal.
Felix Goal, 2026 also, till the end of 2026. We have big plans together, was the shouting slogan when it comes to the Decathlonage des Ardennes. I feel like that's the case here because this man's shown super talent in the Tour de France. He was one of the best climbers in that race. And I'm waiting, like I've said earlier in the podcast, what is that Van Rijssel bike effect going to be towards Felix Gall? Because we've seen some kind of effect with the other riders. So there has to be something going on when it comes to their bike is better. Maybe they've got more motivation out of that and so forth. And I'm curious to see whether he has worked on his TT, because last year he said he didn't spend any time on it, but that he would in the future. There's so many things where I'm looking for Gall to also maybe make that step up again this year. But then when it comes to the climbing, he was so good that you're like, hopefully he can sustain that level while he does those other things.
Yeah, like this guy was the third best climber in the third week of the tour last year.
Yep.
Let's not forget. Col de la Loze rode away from Simon Yates, did Loze super fast. And then on the stage 20, when Pogacar attacked, Jonas was there. And then Gall was next and Gall was pulling. So this guy's a serious climber in serious races. Age of 2R, Decathlon Age of 2R. I was surprised to see this because I thought UAE would have gone hard for him because Mike is out of contract. He's turning 35 this year. I thought you put him in to replace Micah, but I guess Decathlon can offer him more opportunities. He can lead every single race. He does. Yeah. He's going to lead this Paris-Nice. He's going to lead Pays Vasco. He's going to lead the Dauphiné or whatever his prep race is. He's going to lead the Tour on GC. The equipment's better, and maybe they can offer him solid money. So I think that's really positive. I think it's really good that they get to keep him. So I'm really glad that happened. And we'll see if he can repeat what he showed last year. Because it's a big ask to do it 2 years in a row. But hopefully he can. Certainly could be one of the best climbers in the world. He reminds me a little bit of Koos like 3 years ago. The last bit of news, Benji, is the strangest one. which this is just like, this is, what was this?
So the UCI brought out a statement. That's what initiated it for me. That's the first thing I read on their UCI media Twitter account. Decision of the UCI Disciplinary Commission concerning the Seniska cycling team. Seniska is an American women's continental team. And basically it says the disciplinary commission found that although only four riders were present at some random ChatGPT generated women's race in Belgium, only four riders were present, but several members of the team had participated in fraud, attempting to deceive the commissaires panel at the race into believing that a fifth rider was present and could take part in the event. So they couldn't find a fifth rider, or something went wrong and they couldn't have their fifth rider be present. So they, according to this, the mechanic dressed up in rider's clothes and a face mask to present herself at the start as the fifth rider, which, first of all, A plus for effort. At this point, I would have been like, if I'm the commissaire or the UCI disciplinary commission, I'd be like, with that amount of effort, I'm okay with it.
Who is Secondly, checking? Who knows what anyone looks like at this level of racing?
The worst part for me is, I actually think this is not that fun of news if you look at the outcome of it, because I think the DS, Danny Van Houten, was found to be the main perpetrator and was sanctioned with a suspension until December 31st, 2025. And there's more to that. Moira Barrett, the mechanic, is suspended until the 1st of September, 2024. And there's other sanctions that were occurred towards other, I think, riders in the actual team. And then I'm going through this in my head and I'm like, this is a small women's team that is probably fighting to survive every step of the way. And they can't find their fifth rider for that specific race he signed up for.
By the way, and they're a US team. So they can't just get someone to drive to the race.
And they get punished with a 2-year suspension for a DS.
Who gets
fired? Their mechanic suspended. The DS gets fired. Like you said, that's a most recent update now from the team. Sorry, but this is the UCI just hammering down on the small things while the big things go unpunished.
Like, I understand it from sort of from an integrity perspective. But I don't understand sign-ons. Like, why do the riders sign on every day of a stage race?
I don't fucking know. For the show, I thought.
Like, doesn't the DS... I don't really understand that. I'm sure there's like a historical hangover reason for that.
Maybe insurance reasons?
I don't know. But it seems like the reason they did this and went this far, and I'm sure this has happened so many times, like at various levels of cycling, that they've gotten people to sign on because they want to actually, you've spent money, you got four riders ready to do the race.
Yeah.
And like, okay, do you really need five? Like, I don't know if they approached the organizer for a discretion to start with four riders. I mean, this is not the highest level of cycling. Like, come on. Like, this is development. This is participation. This is people doing it for the love of it. They're not trying to make $1 million. So I can understand why they're like, wow, can we just participate? But then, yeah, the whole dressing up charade. I can understand also from the UCI being like, you can't try and defraud the system.
There's proportions when it comes to punishment versus
two
crime.
2 years seems pretty harsh.
This is outrageous to me.
Yeah, 2 years. Because that's his job. He can't work for 2 years. So,
but funny story.
Just very only in cycling, maybe. But this also comes maybe on the back of the UCI release some integrity thing, like a week ago, not a week ago, in the last month.
3 weeks?
Yeah, about how, like, an integrity watch. I think that's more to do with betting. And I don't think there's much betting on the Vuelta Extremadura or whatever this race was. But, yeah, like, if they want to look at integrity, the craziest thing is that there's that bookmakers offer head-to-heads in sprint stages between GC riders. Like, that to me is crazy. Because essentially, a GC rider to beat another GC rider in a sprint stage is a matter of not trying or not, but you don't lose any time. So, like, those are like, should be the highest priority
to monitor those sort of things. But maybe that's what that project is doing. I guess that's a good thing. But I guess on the back of that, you know, less than a month ago, someone participating in fraud is a serious offence under the UCR regulations. So I can see both sides of it, but it's kind of, in the end, it's sad. In the end, it is sad for all parties, I think. And it initially sounded funny, and then it's like, that's a shame.
Exactly.
That's all from us, I believe, this week. I got my taper week on the join program. As I already mentioned, what are you doing this week, Benji?
I still need some training. I'm going to recon some of it. I want to recon some of the Flandrian challenge because I want to kind of figure out, because I'm not necessarily scared of the length or the efforts anymore. I feel like if I've got enough time, I'll get there eventually, even if it's dark. But outside of that, I want to make sure that I don't die in the descents, that I'm able to descend on cobbles, because that's one thing I've never done. Climbing cobbles I've done, descending I haven't. And just have a feel like I'm competent at it to get the motivation for it. That makes sense?
Yeah, I get that. Because, yeah, just what practice makes perfect. I'm riding on a trainer, so I'm doing the opposite of you because it's snowing outside. I'm not crashing again in the snow. So yeah, I was thinking. That's all from us today for our weekly show. We'll be back later on Monday afternoon with the Tirreno Adriatico recap. Otherwise, we'll have some exciting news during this week. We got a little giveaway as well we're putting together for the our Flandrian challenge. We might even have a few of you involved, so make sure you stay tuned for those Tirreno Adriatico and Paranese pods this week, because we'll be releasing details of them in the next coming days. But until then, ciao.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news, ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.